This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
Welcome everybody to our Friday night, our next to last Friday night lecture of the term. It is recording. Ben, turn the button on for me. So we are recording. And we have one more lecture this term, next Friday night, same time, same place, by Donna Petter, The Way of Worship After Wayward Worship. I don't know Donna Petter. Does anyone else here say something? Yeah, Ben, can you say something about?
Professor of Old Testament at Gordon Conwell.
Awesome.
And I believe the lecture is going to be focusing on worship in the book of Ezra.
Yes, that's what it says. Yeah. Great. Thank you, Ben.
Yeah.
So, hope you can make it next week. But tonight, our topic is the changing relationship of young people to work. In the last couple of months, three different people have complained to me about young people in their lives. Dan has a maple syrup business. He has leased close to 16,000 maple trees to tap on a family property of ours up in Vermont. After the sap has stopped running, it's important to pull out the taps as soon as possible so the trees heal. Dan has tried to hire high school students to do this work. He offers to pay them well, but they won't do it. He says they prefer to play video games to doing any work. One agreed to work for him, but never showed up on the job. The second friend of mine recently married a man with a college-age son. He lives in his mother's basement and attends a community college with little motivation. He worked for a week and then quit his job and has not looked for another. His parents gave him a car and have now asked him to pay for gas and insurance. He's outraged by the idea. He's also very depressed. A waitress friend complained about her college daughter for being so entitled. She has a job but refuses to spend any of her earnings on necessary expenses. Her mom says she uses it all to buy designer clothes. And her grandfather doesn't help. While he's alive, he says it gives him pleasure to make his granddaughter happy. So he's buying her a car, paying for insurance, and basically anything else that she wants. Outline. Thank you, Ben. This is only my second time doing PowerPoint, so thank you. This is the outline, so you know I have a plan. Part one, there are many challenges facing young people today. A number of recent books are raising alarm about the ability of the present generation of young people to mature into responsible adults, including the ability to take on adult work. I have not read all of the books I'm going to mention from cover to cover, and I don't agree with everything I have read. But they are important books, and I've read enough of them to think they are worth reading and certainly thinking about. The subtitle of Gene Twenge's book, iGen, it's the name of the book, iGen, the subtitle is long. Why today's super connected kids are growing up less rebellious, more tolerant, less happy, and completely unprepared for adulthood, and what that means for the rest of us. I said it's a long subtitle. She correlates long hours spent on electronic devices and in particular social media with a dramatic increase in depression, anxiety, and suicidal thoughts and deeds among the young. This began to happen shortly after Facebook changed its policy from requiring users to prove that they were in college to users being 13 years old or willing to pretend that they were 13 years old. Twenge writes that adulthood, including adult work, is an, quote, insurmountable goal for many of these young people today. The second book I'll mention is The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt unpack what they call three great untruths internalized by too many of Twenge's cohort, the Internet generation. These untruths are, the first, the untruth of human fragility. The idea that what doesn't kill you makes you weaker. Using Nassim Nicholas Taleb's term, they argue that children, like muscles and bones, are anti-fragile, meaning that they require stressors and challenges in order to learn, to adapt, and to grow. They become rigid, weak, and inefficient when nothing challenges them or pushes them to respond vigorously. That's the first untruth, the fragility of children. The second untruth is the untruth of emotional reasoning. Always trust your feelings, which discounts the use of the mind to analyze truth claims. The third is the untruth of us versus them, a simplistic view of life as a battle between good people and evil people. They argue that these false ideas and a series of cognitive distortions flowing from them have made a generation of kids much more vulnerable and fragile than earlier generations and led to a culture of safetyism on college campuses. Students increasingly feel threatened by freedom of speech because ideas they don't like make them feel unsafe. And well-meaning administration and faculty respond protectively by instituting speech codes, uninviting guest speakers, and providing safe spaces where students who feel triggered, traumatized, and unable to function can go for comfort and recuperation. Lukianoff and Haidt do not minimize, or Haidt, that's how you pronounce his name, H-A-I-D-T. I want to get it right. They do not minimize the reality of real trauma, for example, in those who've experienced sexual assault or any kind of violence. But they argue that the word trauma has undergone what they call concept creep, expanding to include a wide range of experiences and ideas that shouldn't traumatize students. Students should not be traumatized by hearing an opinion or argument that they disagree with. And concept creep has the unintended effect of minimizing the real trauma experienced by students, for example, who have been sexually assaulted. The authors are also not arguing that a college should sponsor, for example, a known white supremacist speaker because a few students request that. They're not arguing for that. Lukianoff and Haidt argue that college administrators are modeling cognitive distortions which exaggerate danger, catastrophizing, thus increasing anxiety and depression and making students even more vulnerable. They explore how the three great untruths and counterproductive policies might interact with Twenge's insights about the adverse effects of screen time and contribute to undermining the ability of the young to mature into strong and resilient adults. Lukianoff and Haidt describe their message as pragmatic, not moralistic. They say, whoever you are, you will be happier, healthier, stronger, and more able to meet your life goals if you seek challenges rather than avoid everything that feels unsafe, resist cognitive distortions rather than always trusting your initial feelings, and take a generous view of other people rather than adopting an us versus them mentality. In their book, the authors argue that the culture of safetyism starts early, particularly in middle-class families. Children are impacted by an overly protective, fearful, helicopter style of parenting, which started in the 1980s and teaches the children these three great untruths. Parents who over-monitor and over-protect their children sap their children of agency. They deny them thousands of small challenges, risks, adversities, and negative experiences that help them develop into competent, resilient, independent adults. Children from poorer backgrounds often face a different set of risks. If they experience chronic, severe adversity without caring, supportive relationships, they too often lack the resilience and perseverance needed for adulthood. It is now known, research has shown, that thousands of hours of play are necessary. And quoting here, including thousands of falls, scrapes, conflicts, insults, alliances, betrayals, status competitions, and acts of exclusion, in order for children's brains to develop normally. Lukianoff and Haidt write, the kind of play that the brain needs is vigorous, physical, free play, outdoors with other children. And this is the kind of play that has decreased dramatically since the 1970s. Surviving the risks involved in free play builds competence and confidence. Children deprived of free play are likely to be more anxious and to become less competent adults, both physically and socially. Free play with other children challenges them, the children, to work out conflicts and fairness disputes on their own without adult intervention. And this is a skill needed for adult life, work, family life, political life. In the third book I'll mention, The Vanishing American Adult, Our Coming-of-Age Crisis and How to Rebuild a Culture of Self-Reliance, Ben Sass worries that the coming generation is lacking the grit, resilience, self-reliance, and problem-solving ability necessary to grow into adulthood. Joshua gave a very helpful review of this book during our theme weekend a couple weekends ago, which is available on podcast. Sass lists 8 markers of adulthood recognized by sociologists. Moving from parents' home, leaving school for the final time, getting a full-time job, reaching economic self-sufficiency, getting married and loss of virginity, having children, and establishing an independent household. Whatever order these markers happen in, they represent expectations and duties associated with maturity and independence, and fewer late teens and 20-somethings are taking these steps in any order. When Sass took on the job as president of Midland University in 2009, he noticed a worrying passivity in many of his students, a lack of experience and interest in doing hard work or adequately completing tasks that they'd begun. He found many of them had an enlarged sense of entitlement and little sense of accountability. Since that time, he has noticed a new verb, to adult, which has emerged in social media. He writes, adulting is an ironic way of describing engagement in adult behaviors like doing laundry or paying bills on time. Sass writes, ours is now an odd nation of both delayed grown-ups and adult children who create words to mock the idea that we could ever become responsible, civic-minded leaders. We're living in an America of perpetual adolescence. Our kids simply don't know what an adult is anymore or how to become one. Many don't see a reason even to try. Perhaps more problematic, the older generations have forgotten that we need to plan to teach them. My last book reference is more positive, I am ending my book references with a little more hopeful note. I will quote Norman Doidge, I guess that's his name, in his foreword to Jordan Peterson's book, 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos. In commenting on the title of this book, Doidge asks, why not call this a book of guidelines? A far more relaxed, user-friendly, and less rigid-sounding term than rules. He said, because these really are rules. And the foremost rule is that you must take responsibility for your own life, period. He goes on, one might think that a generation that has heard endlessly from their more ideological teachers about the rights that belong to them would object to being told that they would do better to focus instead on taking responsibility. Yet, this generation, many of whom were raised in small families by hyper-protective parents on soft-surface playgrounds and then taught in universities with safe spaces where they don't have to hear things they don't want to, schooled to be risk-averse, this generation has now among it millions who feel stultified by this underestimation of their potential resilience and who have embraced Jordan's message that each individual has ultimate responsibility to bear, that if one wants to live a full life, one first sets one's own house in order, and only then can one sensibly aim to take on bigger responsibilities. The extent of their reaction has often moved both of us to the brink of tears. So that's the encouraging part, that a lot of kids realize we've been squashed and stultified and we don't like it. Peterson's book challenges people to stretch themselves beyond the boundaries of your current self and to carefully choose and pursue ideals that are up there, above you, superior to you, and that you can't always be sure you will reach. Deutsch asks, but if it's uncertain that your ideals are attainable, why do we bother reaching in the first place? Because if you don't reach for them, it is certain you will never feel that your life has meaning. So far, I've referred to books that are concerned more broadly with the challenges of the younger generation embracing adulthood, but that includes certainly includes adult work. But from now on, I'll be focusing more on work. And going back to the outline, which I'm not going to do quite now, because I'll get confused. It's arrows. Anyway, my next section is a brief biblical perspective on work as part of responsible dominion. The human need and responsibility to exercise dominion in God's world. This term at Libri, our lectures have been exploring various aspects of what it means for human beings to be images of God who are given the responsibility to exercise accountable dominion, stewardship, and care in God's world. We've looked for other words to express the idea of dominion, since in our culture it often has connotations of domination or exploitation. But creational dominion is describing the human need and obligation for responsible agency, initiative, and making a difference in the world, starting in your own immediate environment, starting with yourself, as Sarah talked about 2 weeks ago, and in your immediate environment. Work is one of the key ways we exercise this dominion. And while the fall has affected our work, turning much of it into frustrating toil, thorns and thistles in the garden, hard labor in childbirth, etc., work itself remains a responsibility and a blessing. We were made for it. So we shouldn't be surprised by the findings of Arthur Brooks. Brooks is the president of the American Enterprise Institute, an economist and expert in the science of happiness. His research indicates that the happiness that we have any control over is determined by four drivers. Faith, by which he means a framework that gives meaning to suffering and death. Family, where there is mutual affection and commitment. And community, at least two really close friends. And the fourth thing is meaningful work that benefits others, not necessarily well-paid work. The Puritans had a very helpful understanding of vocation or calling, which included the whole shape of one's life. There's the general calling of all Christians to discipleship, which would include Brooks's first three happiness factors, faith, family, and community. And there's the special or personal calling of each individual to work for the common good, or in Brooks's words, for the benefit of others. Infants are born as images of God and begin exercising dominion by exploring their world with their bodies, their fingers, their hands, their mouths, their eyes. In young children, play is a crucial forerunner to work. I recommend Mary Frances Giles' lecture on play several years ago, which is on our website. In young children, play is a crucial forerunner to work. I just said that. And it's a significant amount of children's imaginative play is mimicking the adult work that they've either seen or heard about. As babies grow into children and then adolescents, their human need and responsibility to make a difference grows with them. Interestingly, the Old Testament includes 7 or 8 different Hebrew expressions, all of them very pictorial, which designate various developmental stages from infancy to adult maturity. Significantly, the youth or adolescent is described as one who shakes free, one who shakes off, him or her shakes herself free. Good parents are with the program. This is God's program, thoughtfully raising their children step by step toward their independence so they are able to shake free. Otherwise, children may need to break free, or they may be so overdependent on their parents that they're unable to grow up, which is the problem the authors I began with have been highlighting. My third section, I will get back to the outline in a little while, a brief history of young Americans' work. Why consider the past? Aside from the fact that I find social history extremely fascinating, remembering the past helps us relativize the present. Worries about today's young people being capable of maturing into full adulthood is a relatively recent worry. History demonstrates that young people are not intrinsically incapable of growing into adulthood and responsible work. In fact, they are far more competent than our culture tends to give them credit for or opportunity to demonstrate. We obviously cannot turn the clock back, although remember to do it tomorrow night. Sorry. Daylight saving. But we can't, in the big sense, in the large sense, turn the clock back and return to pre-industrial or pre-technological time, and for many reasons we should not want to. But there are things we can do differently in our homes, churches, schools, and neighborhoods to resist the destructive pressures of our culture. We should also be encouraged by and give thanks for the young people that we are blessed to know who do not fit the profile suggested by the authors I just mentioned, for there are many of them, and I'm blessed to know some of them. Awesome people. Now for a very abbreviated and selective history of young Americans' past relationship to work. And I need to begin by pointing out that the work experience of young people, children and teenagers, throughout American history has varied greatly depending on gender, class, race, region, ethnicity, geography, and religion. Pre-modern, pre-industrial childhood roughly coincides with the colonial era. Children's work experience in the colonies varied significantly by geography and race. The South was characterized by unstable families and a high percentage of unfree young people. It was common for children in Aberdeen, Scotland, to be kidnapped and sold as indentured servants in America. Parents wouldn't let their kids out in the streets because this was so common. Robert Louis Stevenson's book, Kidnapped, was inspired by his own boyhood experience. South of New England, two-thirds of all immigrants arrived in a state of unfreedom as indentured servants, apprentices, convicts, or slaves. Female servants were frequently raped by their masters, and one half of all indentured servants died before their term of service was completed. During the 18th century, the English alone imported 1.5 million Africans into their New World colonies, including the West Indies, including many teenagers and children. No children suffered more from inhuman conditions, exhausting labor, separation from families, malnutrition, and high mortality than did slave children. Stephen Mintz, in his book Huck's Raft, A History of American Childhood, writes of the pain enslaved parents felt at the birth of a child. One slave mother addressed her newborn with this heartbreaking poem: "And much I grieve and mourn that to so dark a destiny my lovely babe I've borne." Similarly, Thomas Jones, a slave father, described, quote, "unspeakable anguish as I looked upon my precious babes and have thought of the ignorance, degradation, and woe which they must endure as slaves." Children's songs expressed dread of family separation. "Mammy, is old massa going to sell us tomorrow?" "Yes, my child." "Where are you going to sell us?" "Way down south in Georgia." These are songs children sang. This photo of a slave family was taken in 1861 or 62. The absence of adolescent children is no accident, as over half of all slaves were sold away from their families during their teens. Young people fared better in New England, where family and community life were more stable. Puritans viewed children as adults in training with defined stages of growth. The first stage was infancy, which lasted until the age of 6 or 7, during which time children were primarily under their mother's care. This stage was followed by childhood and youth, a prolonged period which lasted from 7 or 8 until the early to mid-20s. This period began for boys with a ceremony called breeching, when they first wore breeches or pants. At that time, the father took over their care and their work responsibilities increased. Boys began fetching water, tending livestock, and doing other chores for their families. Girls' work responsibilities also increased in the home: spinning, cooking, candle making, and housework, and in the garden. Some children between the ages of 7 and 12 were fostered out to live with and work for another family, but older children lived with their own families. As children became physically and sexually mature, they entered the stage of youth, when they gradually gained autonomy and adult work skills. They were expected to put away childish things, and choose a vocation. Massachusetts laws in 1643 and 1646 charged parents and masters with the responsibility to breed and bring up their children and apprentices in some honest calling, labor, or employment. To give you a sense of how challenging the process of finding a calling could be, Stephen Mintz describes, with the help of Franklin's autobiography, how Benjamin Franklin became an apprentice printer. Quote, "When he was 8, his father sent him to a grammar school to prepare him for the ministry. His father could not afford the schooling, and at 10, Benjamin was withdrawn and began to assist his father in the manufacture of candles and soap. Bored by dipping wicks into wax, the boy hoped to go to sea, but his father rejected this option. Fearing that Benjamin would run away, as another son already had, the father, quote, took me to walk with him and see joiners, bricklayers, turners, braziers, etc., at their work, that he might observe my inclination and endeavor to fix it on some trade or other on land." Finally, the elder Franklin decided his son would become a cutler who would make, repair, or sell knives, and sent him to live with an uncle's son who was practicing that trade. But when the man demanded a fee, Benjamin returned home and was apprenticed to a much older brother, a master printer. Thus, Benjamin became a printer. We learn something about colonial children's work from the stories of so-called white Indians, English colonists who by their own choice lived with Native Americans. They either ran away from home or were taken captive and chose to stay with their captors. This painting is called "The Indians Delivering Up the English Captives to Colonel Bouquet." It depicts a white child recoiling from a British soldier and reaching for his adopted Indian parents. Mintz writes, "When children were redeemed by the English, they often cried as if they should die. Treated with great kindness by the Indians and freed from the work obligations imposed on colonial children, many young people preferred life in captivity. Boys hunted, caught fish, and gathered nuts, but were not obliged to do any of the farm chores that colonial boys were required to perform. Girls planted, tended, and harvested corn, but had no master," quoting one of these girls, "to oversee or drive us, so we could work as leisurely as we pleased." In 1753, Benjamin Franklin described this phenomenon. "When white persons of either sex have been taken prisoners young by the Indians and lived a while among them, though ransomed by their friends and treated with all imaginable tenderness to prevail with them to stay among the English, yet in a short time they become disgusted with our manner of life and the care and pains that are necessary to support it, and they take the first good opportunity of escaping again into the woods from whence there is no reclaiming them." I don't know how many children did this, but it seems to be those who were captured young and lived with Indians, the Native Americans, for a while. I just want to summarize some reflections on the pre-modern, pre-industrial work experience of young people in New England and elsewhere in the colonial era. For the vast majority of colonists, life was shaped by small-scale farming in village communities. The family was a business, with each household more or less self-sufficient and each family member doing their part. Yale historian John Demos writes, "Work, indeed, was a wholly natural extension of family life and merged imperceptibly with all of its other activities." In his book, Past, Present, and Personal, Demos writes, "Children move toward maturity along a smoothly surfaced path. Their introduction to adult roles began early, about 7 or 8. Culturally appropriate adult models were present and visible from the start. Therefore, as children and teenagers, they did not feel alienated from the adult world of work. Families were very large, 8 to 10 children per married couple, born over a period of as much as 20 years. This meant an implicit blurring of intergenerational lines. Many children could envision their own progress toward adulthood by reference to older siblings variously situated along the way. Whereas today, the full-time work of young people is compulsory, age-graded schooling, in colonial times, the multi-generational home functioned as school and vocational institution. Massachusetts law required that parents and masters attended to the education of all their children in their care. Puritan leaders insisted that all members of the community be taught to read so that they could all read the Bible. Common schools began to appear in some towns toward the end of the colonial period. Excuse me. But schooling was seasonal, as children were expected to help with the harvest in the summer. The knowledge and skills needed for farming and all the trades and crafts were also learned in households where apprenticeships took place. The family home is also where social welfare work was done. The home functioned as hospital, orphanage, retirement home for the elderly, and sometimes as house of correction for criminals and idle people. Young people were involved in all of this work alongside adults in the context of their homes. The onset of puberty, or adolescence, was associated with the growing strength and effectiveness needed to take on adult roles. It was not seen as a particularly awkward, stormy, stressful, or vulnerable life stage, as it is today. Demas writes, "The only form of personal crisis particularly associated with youth was religious conversion." I want to speak briefly now about the effect of war on young people's work. Young people shared the revolutionary zeal of their elders who revolted against British taxation without representation. This engraving depicts children and young people participating in the tarring and feathering of John Malcolm, a British customs official in Boston. It was common for young people to apply the rhetoric of liberty to their own situations and to leave farms, schools, and apprenticeships to serve in the Revolutionary War. Indentured servants gained their freedom by fighting in the war. Boys as young as 11 or 12 served as scouts, collecting news, spies, soldiers, messengers, cooks, drummer boys, and sailors. Young soldiers were promised land or cash as payment for their service. Girls made cartridges, wallets, and food and brought bullets to soldiers. African-American youth also fought in the war, and many were able to gain freedom from slavery. Many of the founders of our country were young. Alexander Hamilton was a pamphleteer as a 19-year-old college student. He was a captain in an artillery company at age 21, and at 22, he joined General Washington's staff as a lieutenant colonel. James Madison was 24, and James Monroe only 17 when he served with Washington. Young people were also involved in all aspects of the Civil War. In 1862, President Lincoln prohibited under 18-year-olds from enlisting, but recruiting officers looked the other way, and thousands of underage boys joined the war effort as drummers, messengers, hospital orderlies, and full-fledged soldiers. This photo shows a young man, a teenager, I suppose, named Taylor, who served as a drummer with the 78th Regiment U.S. Colored Infantry. This young boy was a powder monkey carrying explosives on board warships. At age 14, Susie Baker became a laundress and nurse for a black regiment. She also taught 40 African-American children by day and led a night school for adults. Born a slave, Susie had learned to read and write at a secret school run by a free black woman. She did all that at 14. I want to talk now about industrialization and the invention of modern middle-class childhood or youth. The early 19th century was a time of great fluidity and uncertainty for young people. The pre-industrial socioeconomic order was breaking down, and the road to adulthood was much less clear than it had been in pre-industrial New England. New employment, schooling and religious options were opening up, and teenage boys and girls were leaving farms and villages to live and work in larger towns and cities. Mintz describes this as the moment when, quote, modern childhood was invented. Confined at first to the urban middle class and initially limited to the years from birth to 13 or 14, modern childhood was to be free from labor and devoted to schooling. This new child-rearing approach was based on a romantic conception of childhood, which had a number of sources. Liberal Protestants saw children as pure, innocent souls. Romantics idealized their emotional expressiveness, spontaneity, and intuitive thinking. Concern for children's vulnerability led to the establishment of new child-centered institutions, including Sunday schools, public schools, orphanages, reform schools, and children hospitals. The need was huge. After the Civil War, there were just thousands of orphan children who were on the streets, and so the need to do something with these children was prompted reformers to. At one point, they had orphan trains, and they took train loads of orphans out, and they were sort of fostered on farms in the West, in the Midwest, to look after farms, get to put them in families, and give them work. Laws prohibiting child labor and mandating school attendance had the effect of prolonging childhood dependency. No longer moving to and from their parents' homes to work elsewhere, middle-class children lived with their parents continuously into their late teens or early 20s. In colonial families, children were necessary economic assets. In contrast, raising modern middle-class children was costly. Parents considered children not as sources of labor, but as social capital, requiring a substantial investment of time and money in the form of education. This period also coincided with a dark irony. As middle-class children were freed from work to pursue education, the labor of poor children became more grueling and simultaneously more necessary for their family's survival. Industrialization, the commercialization of agriculture, and the expansion of a market economy widened the gulf between middle-class and working-class children, many of whom were immigrants. At the turn of the century, turn of the 20th century, 2 million children labored in factories, mills, and mines. This photo shows breaker boys who worked in a Pennsylvania coal mine in 1911, separating slate and other impurities from coal. This little girl is called a spinner in a cotton mill in South Carolina. The pre-modern integration of farm work and family life changed dramatically when industrialization removed economic work from the home, ending many apprenticeships and skilled home-based trades. There was a transition time of great upheaval and suffering as people adjusted to a new economic system. Many poor children, many among them children of immigrants, worked, as I said, under appalling conditions in factories, mills, and mines. In pre-industrial America, just to give you some statistics, in pre-industrial America, most of children's work took place on family farms. In 1790, 90% of the workforce consisted of farmers. In 1840, 70% were farmers. In 1900, less than 40%. 1980, only 4.5% were farmers in this country. And in 2017, farmers made up between 1 and 2% of the workforce in America. To make the enormity of this change more concrete, I want to refer to Laura Ingalls Wilder's book, Farmer Boy. It's a true story of her husband's boyhood on a farm in upstate New York. As a son of a farmer, Almanzo worked alongside his father and brothers starting at an early age. He also went to school, but was glad for the days he got to stay home because he was needed on the farm. One gets the sense that he was always straining forward toward the next responsibility that would move him closer to adulthood. He wanted to train the colts, but they could easily be spoiled and made untrainable, so his father would not let him take on such a sensitive and difficult task until he was better prepared. So Pa gave him two young oxen to train. There he is. He made them a yoke and trained them to follow commands, pull carts and sleighs, and eventually to plow the fields. One morning they ran bawling around the farmyard and disobeyed all his orders just because they loved to run. Wilder writes, Almanzo was so mad he shook all over and tears ran down his cheeks. He wanted to yell at those mean calves and kick them and hit them over the head with the butt of his whip. But he didn't. Afterward, he told Father about it because he thought anyone who was as patient as that with the calves was patient enough to be allowed at least to curry comb the colts. But Father didn't seem to think of that. All he said was, "That's right, son. Slow and patient does it. Keep on that way and you'll have a good yoke of oxen yet." You get a wonderful sense in this book of how a young boy growing up on a farm, was raised to be able to take on adult work and to grow in character virtues in the process. Grow in patience and delayed gratification, having to wait and work to be able to train the colts. Between the 1870s and the late 1930s, child labor battles raged, fueled by arguments from two groups who had conflicting views of childhood. Child labor reformers believed that childhood work violated the sentimental value of children. A child's contribution to the family economy was redefined as the mercenary exploitation of parents, even though, in the case of many working-class families, children's earnings were absolutely essential to the family's survival. Their opponents argued that American children had always worked, and their labor was critical to the survival of late 19th century urban families. In her book, Pricing the Priceless Child, Viviana Zelizer writes, "The price of a youthful wage-earning child was directly counterposed to the moral value of an economically useless but emotionally priceless child." In other words, the economic and sentimental value of children was declared to be radically incompatible. By 1937, the combination of legislation prohibiting child labor, compulsory education laws, and the victory of the sentimental definition of childhood sealed the coffin on the older pre-industrial useful child, the child who worked. What about household chores? The sentimental view of children necessitated a new way of justifying the household chores that many children were still expected to help with. It was fine for children to help with light housework as long as everyone realized that they were doing chores for their own good, educational and character building, not as a needed contribution to the household division of labor. That would be exploitation. So Zelizer writes, household chores were therefore not intended to be real work, but lessons in helpfulness, order, and unselfishness. And parents were warned to take great care not to overburden the child with responsibility. And above all, warned Parents Magazine in 1934, never give children cause to suspect us of making use of them to save ourselves work. Close quote. Drink of water. I want to jump ahead now and listen to Joseph Kett, the author of Rites of Passage, Adolescence in America from 1790 to the Present. When the book was published, the present was 1977. His analysis is so compelling. I'm going to read a passage from the beginning of his book. It clearly, even before the era of electronic devices, cell phones, social media, socioeconomic changes and new understandings of childhood and adolescence had come together in a way that made growing up more challenging. So we'll consider now, we're in point number four, a youth revolution viewed from the late 1970s. Joseph Kett starts his book with this paragraph. Those who measure the success of revolutions by their completeness will judge the revolution which has overtaken American young people in recent decades to be one of the most successful. Compared to their predecessors in 1800 or 1900, young people in the 1970s spend much more time in school, much less at work. They are essentially consumers rather than producers. Their contacts with adults are likely to occur in highly controlled environments, such as the classroom, and the adults encountered are usually conveyors of specialized services, such as education and guidance. For the most part, young people in the 1970s spend their time in the company of other young people. To observe that youth today are primarily consumers rather than producers is not to deny their economic importance. Indirectly, young people sustain a wide range of service occupations: teachers, guidance counselors, adolescent psychologists, market research analysts, printers, clothiers, disc jockeys, even policemen and judges. But the economic and social relationship between youth and adults has clearly changed. Further, the change has been abrupt as well as profound. Its roots can be traced back to the late 19th century when industrialization began to displace young workers. But only since 1945 have vast numbers of American youth experienced the mixture of leisure, affluence, and education that now distinguishes their social position. I suggest that the youth revolution Kett describes shapes our culture even more dramatically than it did in the late 1970s. I'm going to speak now about the invention of adolescence. The word adolescence comes from the Latin to grow up. There is obviously a cross-cultural biological component to adolescence, physical and sexual maturation. But culture is also a huge determinant in shaping the experience and behavior of young people at this critical stage in the human life cycle between childhood and adulthood. Quoting Keck, says, if adolescence is defined as the period after puberty during which a young person is institutionally segregated from casual contacts with a broad range of adults, then it can scarcely be said to have existed at all until the 20th century. Around the turn of the century, a number of things that I've already spoken of came together and led to what Kett and others have called the invention of adolescence. These include industrialization, child labor laws, and compulsory education. Simultaneously, between 1890 and 1920, a host of professionals, psychologists, teachers, youth workers, urban reformers, and parent counselors gave shape to the new concept of adolescence, which had profound and unintended consequences. The new view was articulated in great detail by G. Stanley Hall, who was a professor at Clark University in Worcester, in his 1904 book. I'm probably pointing in the wrong direction, because I'm always pointing in, I don't know where Worcester is. Anyway, it's near. His book was published in 1904, long title, Adolescence, Its Psychology and Its Relations to Physiology, Anthropology, Sociology, Sex, Crime, Religion, and Education. For the first time in history, adolescence was defined as a conflict-ridden, psychologically volatile, biological life stage full of storm and stress. Hall and others singled out sexual maturation as the most significant, all-encompassing thing that happens to adolescents. And it was believed to cause such inner turmoil that young people were rendered vulnerable, awkward, and even incapacitated. He asserted that behavior that could be considered insane in an adult was normal in an adolescent. These experts believed that in order for the transition to adulthood to happen successfully, the young, now reclassified as adolescents, needed to be institutionally segregated and protected from the adult world with all of its intellectual, political, religious, and work concerns. Sexual maturation was believed to be so all-encompassing and draining that young people couldn't handle dealing with anything else. To help them maneuver this stressful period, a whole array of adult-sponsored youth organizations and institutions were established, like the Scouting Movement, age-graded high school, and organized sports. Significantly, the main purpose of these organizations, even the high school, was socialization rather than intellectual growth. And since young people were in age-graded classes separated from the adult world, in practice, socialization was restricted to peers. Historians talk of the invention rather than the discovery of adolescence because the new views were not based on actual observation of youth behavior, but rather on new psychological theories. Before the middle of the 19th century, the changes in size, sexual maturity, and intellectual capability associated with the teen years were viewed as milestones of progress toward competent adulthood rather than a cause for crisis and alarm. And we know from the history that adolescents have been handling a great deal more freedom, independence, and work responsibility without suffering the dire consequences that the psychologists predicted. Interestingly, census classifications after 1740 designated under 16-year-olds as dependents, whereas 16 to 60-year-olds were the productive ages, starting at 16. During the mid to late 19th century, young people had also organized, during the mid-19th to late 19th century, young people had organized their own extracurricular activities, including sports clubs, speech and debating clubs, political organizations, music and drama clubs, prayer meetings, and other religious organizations. These autonomous student-run organizations disappeared and were replaced by adult-run sports teams and organizations like Boys and Girl Scouts and Campfire Girls. Mintz gives a couple of reasons why students submitted to adult control of their free time. He says the schools offered better facilities and coaching than the kids could provide for themselves. That was the first reason. But he said it also reflected a shift in the students' self-perception. As high schools grew in importance, as high schools grew more important and assumed a more all-encompassing role in middle-class lives, students began to see themselves as juveniles and became more and more acquiescent. It seemed appropriate to them that adults who knew better should organize their leisure as well as their academic activities. But he points out that within the structure set by schools and adult-sponsored organizations, young people created cultures of their own. And I want to look now at the development of a separate youth culture growing out of this. In the years since adolescence was first defined and constructed, a great deal has changed. But the primary institution of adolescence, the high school, is still with us, and it's expanded downward in years to include middle and elementary schools, and upward to include college. And since the 1950s, adults have provided kids with money and leisure and exposed them to an electronic entertainment industry that wants to keep them in a state of so-called adolescence for as long as possible. In other words, segregated from the adult world with peers and assaulted with the message that looking good, sex, social life, popularity, fashion, and consumption are the only things that matter. And of course, these destructive elements of youth culture have been amplified by the addition of electronic devices and social media. Is it any wonder that a lot of kids behave the way adults have defined and treated them? A few years ago, a friend of ours who was at the time in college taught a summer class on teen issues to a group of teenagers. At the end of the class, she asked for evaluation, and one young man said, "I was really disappointed with this because all you talked about was sex. Aren't there other teen issues? I'm concerned about politics, about the mind, about work. What am I going to be doing? About family issues, about money. Aren't those teen issues?" I said to my friend, "Hooray for this boy." Yeah, absolutely. He was right to object to being treated as if the only teen issue was sex, the only issue important. Okay. The authors of Dancing in the Dark explore what they call the symbiotic relationship between the electronic media and youth. Their thesis is that the media, now a multi-billion dollar industry, need the youth market, as it is called, for their own economic survival. Youth, in turn, need the media for guidance and nurture, particularly as homes, churches, schools, and the like have become ineffective nurturing institutions. The media have moved in to fill the gap, in the process widening the gap between youth and traditional nurture. I'll speak now about youth as consumers with their own disposable incomes. Lots of high school kids have jobs when they're not in school, but for most of them, most middle-class kids, work has become almost exclusively an opportunity for immediate gratification, to buy clothing, accessories, footwear for their social budget, including eating out, music, movies, video games, electronic devices, and what comes under the category of my selfie budget. For most of these kids, their basic living expenses are carried by parents, so all their earnings can be used to indulge what one researcher calls premature affluence. Ben Sasse worries that what he calls core American traits of self-denial and deferred gratification are totally foreign to most young people today, even scorned by many. He sees no urgency about learning to produce before consuming. The Notre Dame sociologist Christian Smith surveyed and conducted extensive interviews with emerging adults, that's a phrase, a label which Ben Sasse calls a rich nation designation, not a universal life stage. But emerging adults are marked by more years in school, later marriage and parenthood, and prolonged and erratic transition to stable work. Smith found that a majority of people born after 1995 and millennials, those born between 1980 and 1995, are, quote, unreflexively materialistic and captive to consumerism. Well over half of the emerging adults that he interviewed agreed that their well-being can be measured by what they own and that buying more things would make them happier. Many of those interviewed had never done any productive work. However, these same people, rather than feeling upbeat and hopeful, Smith found that their dominant feelings were loneliness, confusion, anxiety, hurt, frustration, and grief. Many of them admitted to being morally adrift and captive to consumerism, disengaged civilly and politically, and seeking pleasure in meaningless hookups and binge drinking. They feared leading unproductive, unfulfilling lives. Tony Campolo argues that consumer-oriented young people, not unlike adults, buy what they do because of the deep spiritual hungers of their hearts and souls. They buy certain goods because they long for the love that those who possess those things are supposed to enjoy. The media manipulates them into thinking that their sexual identities will be firmly established, that they'll be validated as human beings if they wear the right clothes. They become alienated from what they really need. Instead, they become persons who have to buy things they don't really need. Today, far from being economic assets, young people are, by and large, huge expenses to their families. Increasingly, children are considered an expensive luxury that many adults are deciding they can do without. There are important exceptions. Many children in poor families, single-parent households, and immigrant families work to help pay for groceries, rent, and other necessities. And a small minority of children still work on farms. Illegal child labor is also a harsh reality. It's estimated that during an average week in 2018, over 2 million hours of illegal work are done by children and teenagers.
In America.
There are also middle-class young people who work to contribute toward their educations and other family needs. But these seem to be exceptions. Most of the money earned by middle-class kids today is spent on entertainment and the paraphernalia of the youth culture. But now I want to say, don't blame the kids. Adults created the world they're growing up in. Did you know that the word teenager was first used to refer to a class of people in 1941? The context was a marketing one. Teenagers were defined by their shared experience, high school, being young, open to new things, having money, and being easy to sell to. The youth market is highly attractive to advertisers because young people spend a lot of money, are impressionable, and are forming habits that may last a lifetime. In his 1999 book, The Rise and Fall of the American Teenager, Thomas Hines summarized some of the culture's unhelpful and contradictory beliefs about teenagers. I quote him, "They should be free to become themselves. They need many years of study and training. They know more about the future than adults do. They know hardly anything at all. They ought to know the value of a dollar. They should be protected from the world of work. They are frail, vulnerable creatures. They are children. They are sex fiends. They are the death of the culture. They are the hope of us all." He calls this a teenage mystique, which encourages adults to see teenagers and young people to see themselves not as individuals, but as potential problems. Such a pessimistic view of the young can easily lead adults to feel that they are powerless to help young people make better lives for themselves. Thus, the teenage mystique can serve as an excuse for elders to neglect the coming generation and ultimately to see their worst fears realized. He writes, teenagers are offered few immediate and meaningful ways to test their newfound powers, to feel needed, to be essential members of a community. We tell them they're the future, and that's true, but they need opportunities to take responsibility for the here and now. Age segregation was also invented by adults. Patricia Hirsch wrote a very moving book in 1998 called A Tribe Apart, A Journey into the Heart of American Adolescence. After spending 3 years closely following the lives of 8 American teenagers, as she called herself, a silent, attentive partner, she describes the dramatic separation of young people from the adult world, where kids are left on their own to make their own choices and determine their own fates. Everyone suffers when the generations are so separated. Conversations and idea exchanges between generations do not occur. Guidance and role modeling does not take place. Wisdom and traditions no longer filter down naturally. She writes, American society has left its children behind as the cost of progress in the workplace. Adolescents are growing up with no adults around, a deficit of attention, and no discussion about whether it matters at all. And consider social media, another invention of adults, though they might have been young adults. I'm not sure. In a 2017 interview, Sean Parker, the first president of Facebook, explained the early strategy. It was all about capturing eyeballs. Quote, how do we consume as much of your time and conscious attention as possible? And that means that we need to sort of give you a little dopamine hit every once in a while because someone liked or commented on a photo or a post or whatever. And that's going to get you to contribute more content. And that's going to get you more likes and comments. It's a social validation feedback loop, exactly the kind of thing that a hacker like myself would come up with because we're exploiting a vulnerability in human psychology. In the same interview, Parker said, God only knows what it's doing to the children's brains. My final section is hope for the future. What can we do to ease the transition to adulthood and specifically to adult work? The first thing to say is that adult lives, our lives, must be attractive to young people. That's the challenge of modeling. The adults they see must be the kind of people they want to be like, not following their exact jobs or vocations or whatever, but they must have attractive qualities that makes them want to aim toward adulthood. And that's assumed in everything that I say from now on. First of all, some thoughts for parents and caregivers of children. Start early, making work a normal and meaningful part of your children's lives, in the home, the church, where possible, in schools and neighborhoods. In the home, give children age-appropriate work that needs to be done, not token unnecessary work invented for their character building, because that kind of work does not build character. It builds resentment, and it does not contribute to a child's healthy sense of agency or dominion by making an immediate contribution to the family's well-being. Don't demand perfection, but praise and thank kids for a job completed well. Young children work alongside someone older. It's sociable, and they can absorb the attitude that the work of the home is good, important, and has dignity. Children can learn to pick up their things, to help hang, fold, and sort laundry. They can help with meal preparation and baking. Ben and Akela's twin 11-year-old daughters recently cooked an entire meal for their family, with some help from Danny, I believe. But they were thrilled. They told me all about what they made. They were thrilled with their accomplishment, and their parents were saved meal preparation. Taking care of animals is a good thing, if you have animals, and having the children do some of that care. Consider which of the services that you pay for could be done by your children instead. Like fire the landscaping company. Let your kids mow the lawn, rake the leaves, do the spring and autumn cleanup, etc. Ben Sass gives ideas for building toward adult work. At 12, one of his sons bought many of the family's tickets to when they traveled, and his 15-year-old son conducted some family financial transactions. His children helped plan family trips. If our 15-year-old grandson lived closer, we would pay him to fix our computers, because he could do that. Take young people from home or church to help single parents or elderly folk with their housework and shopping and whatever, breaking leaves. Parents who are good at making and repairing things can teach their children these skills. Involve children in planning the family division of labor when they're old enough. And take your children to work. Many children love making things, making potholders, note cards, knitting scarves, making bracelets. Some of you know who I'm talking about right now. Grandchildren that live very close to here. Encourage them and look for opportunities, craft sales, and so on, where they can sell their wares. Encourage young people to babysit. Dick and I recently heard an interview with one of the authors of the book Raising Cain, Protecting the Emotional Life of Boys. He referred to research showing that boys who care for younger children, like, for example, camp counselors who comfort homesick and injured campers, develop into much more empathetic men than boys who never look after younger children. It's a good reason for sons to babysit young children. Hire the children of friends and neighbors. One of our sons asked a neighbor whose property needed a lot of attention if he could work for him. The neighbor agreed, and Tim could walk to work. It was a house that used to be right next door. Our sons were also blessed to be able to work several summers for a friend, Tom Little, in his restaurant upholstery business. They learned something about running a small business, and our two older sons later started a house painting business during high school and college summers. They contributed a percentage of their earnings toward school expenses. A And while painting and living at home, we asked them to shop, plan, and prepare dinner one night each week. When Dick and I moved to Hopkinton in 2010, I started hiring an 8-year-old neighbor to help me with gardening. He is now a bigger and stronger 14-year-old, and for some strange reason still enjoys working and chatting with this woman in her 70s. We still work together. Child labor laws can restrict the opportunities for teenage employment, and often the only jobs available are fast food jobs or sales jobs, but we can encourage them with a positive attitude toward the dignity of all honest work. Teaching children to work initially takes more time and patience than doing it yourself. Those of us who have raised or are now raising children in La Brie have many advantages, since both parents work from home with a flexible division of labor. And there's a lot of work on La Brie properties that children can help with. As a boy, Nate Morell, son of our former colleagues, learned to stack and split wood with Dick. Eventually, with his parents' permission, Dick taught him to use a chainsaw. The rest is history. Nate studied to be an arborist, and for the last few years has worked in that field for a tree company. For those who work long hours away from home, I want to challenge those who can to think of ways for at least one parent to spend more time at home with their children. This may involve significant lifestyle changes. With the wisdom of social history, Thomas Hines observes, what contemporary Americans are attempting, providing a prolonged, protected period of childhood and youthful preparation for our offspring, while both parents work outside the household, is novel. In the past, when both parents worked, their children did so as well. On farms, work and family life were essentially inseparable. And when schooling became the job of the young, it was usually supported by a non-working mother maintaining a household that explicitly supported educational values. Our attempt to maintain an elaborate domestic life with nobody home is an experiment that seems doomed to fail. Close quote. The elaborate life Hines refers to includes the overscheduling of young people's lives with many after-school activities. Given all the research on children's need for unsupervised free play and exploration, we should consider some adult-run activities that they can drop, especially ones that they don't want to keep doing. Lukianoff and Height recommend two websites for good ideas. One of them is letgrow.org, and the other one is freerangekids.com. I have not had time to look at them, so they're recommending them. I haven't looked at them yet, but another thing we can do is resist age segregation wherever we can. Almost all of life in our culture is age-graded, and sadly, most churches duplicate this pattern. But there is no biblical reason for this. Many biblical exhortations assume informal, intergenerational relationships to be the norm. Jesus said to his disciples, unless you change and become like little children, you'll never enter the kingdom of heaven. Paul wrote to the church in Corinth, be infants in evil, but in thinking, be adults. Infants do not premeditate evil and are in that respect models for adults. Maybe there are other ways infants are meant to be. That's the one that struck me. You can talk about that later. Other ways that infants should be models for adults. But if you don't know any infants or children, how will you be able to follow their example? Proverbs 20, verse 29 says, the glory of youth, the glory of the adolescent, is their strength. And the New Testament church needed the visions of the young as much as it needed the dreams of the old. Learned that in Acts 2. As Thomas Hines writes, we need to get rid of G.S. Hall's discredited notion of the adolescent as incompetent, troubled, half-mad, and dangerous, along with the stereotype of raging hormones that gives the old prejudice a pseudo-scientific veneer. He says, young people should be treated as beginning adults who need to learn that their decisions have consequences, although not necessarily irreversible ones. They should be encouraged to experiment, to try something new and unlikely, and fail at it without being branded a failure for life. They ought to be able to follow many different paths, yet be protected as beginners from going too far astray. Hines expresses here, I don't know whether he's a Christian or not, but he expresses a biblical perspective on failure. We all fail at times. Failure is part of life in a broken world, and it is not the end of the world. By God's grace, we can be forgiven. if our failure needs forgiveness, sometimes it doesn't. But if it does, we can be forgiven, we can learn from our failures, and we can get up and try again. Christian homes and churches must model this reality of grace. A few years ago, a team of researchers from Fuller Seminary did a 4-year study of churches that were effectively engaging 15 to 29-year-olds. To their amazement and surprise, the single most important factor that drew young people to church and kept them there was cross-generational community. Caring for young people was embedded in the culture of the whole church. It was not limited to the youth pastor's job. It was the whole church. Teenagers were treated as full-fledged members playing load-bearing roles in the church. They felt loved, respected, and needed because they were loved, respected, and needed. Help children resist the allure of screens. Research has shown that more than 2 hours a day on electronic devices or TV correlates with higher levels of depression, anxiety, and suicide-related outcomes. 5 activities have an inverse relationship with these things. Sports and other forms of exercise, attending religious services, reading books and other print media, in-person social interactions, and doing homework. Clearly, those are things to encourage and also to model. If adults are on their screens all the time, what's that teaching the kids? Thomas Hines challenges the contemporary monolithic pattern of education, which he argues makes it difficult for teenagers to imagine themselves living useful lives. He suggests that some young people would be better served by making working and learning more flexible, by removing the stigma of school dropout and increasing opportunities to be school drop-ins. At the same time, high schools should better coordinate education and work opportunities and student volunteerism. Our oldest grandson, our 15-year-old grandson, is attending Blackstone Valley Technical School, a charter school that is designed very much with these goals. Students apply for a particular track. It could be manufacturing, information technology, hairdressing, car maintenance, electronics, culinary arts, the whole array of different tracks. And then their school weeks alternate between their particular vocational track and a liberal arts curriculum, English, social studies, math, science, and so on. After graduating, many students continue academic study at 4-year colleges, but many others are employable on graduation. Though not everyone is suited for a 4-year college, and they're employable. They can get jobs when they graduate. Lukianoff and Haidt have seen great success using cognitive behavioral therapy to free people from cognitive distortions that make them depressed. I'm not going to talk about CBT or describe it, but in one way, it's similar to what the psalmists often do, talking back to untruths. The psalmist often talks back to the lies that they hear in their own head. Talking back to untruths is modeled in the Psalms, and it's something we can do with not just as a psychological technique, but we can do it with the authority and power of God. When the tape recorder in my head says, "You are a hopeless loser," or "You always screw things up," it's with God's authority that I can talk back and say, "No, that's a lie. I don't always screw things up. Sometimes I screw things up, but not always. And I'm loved, forgiven, adopted, and treasured by the God who made the universe." That's the truth. I can talk back to those lies the way the psalmist did. In Psalm 42, the psalmist asked himself, "Why are you cast down? Why are you depressed? Cast down, oh my soul. Why are you disquieted? Why are you anxious within me? Hope in God, for I shall again praise him, my help and my God." I'm depressed and anxious now, but I know, because he reminds himself in that psalm, of God's past faithfulness and of God's caring for him now, so he can know, he can hold on to that hope. I know it's going to get better. I know that I will again praise you, my help and my God. So far, most of the suggestions have been practical, but Christian Smith's research on emerging adults points to the bigger need. Young people and all people need to know that our work and our lives have ultimate meaning. Ernest Becker was an existentialist philosopher who seem to understand better than many Christians how the biblical story and worldview provides this ultimate meaning. In his book, The Birth and Death of Meaning, Becker argues that modern materialism, loss of belief in God and the unseen world, has brought about a crisis of belief in the vitality of the hero systems that are offered by contemporary materialist society. The young no longer feel heroic in doing as their elders did. And that's that. Becker, a non-Christian, chastises the Christian church for having been co-opted by materialism and in the process throwing away its heritage, which provided a unique basis for the dignity and heroism of all human endeavor and work. He writes, "For those who believe in a creator and the unseen world, anyone who serves God can achieve, even in the smallest daily tasks, that sense of cosmic heroism that is the highest ambition of humanity." Close quote. The biblical story of creation, fall, redemption, and future glory gives cosmic meaning to our lives and to our work. The Apostle Paul wrote that because Jesus defeated death on the cross and was raised from the dead, you know that in the Lord your labor is not in vain. The psalmist says that in spite of our mortality, God will establish the work of our hands. And in the book of Revelation, the Apostle John hears a voice from heaven saying, "Blessed are the dead who from now on die in the Lord. Yes, says the Spirit, they will rest from their labors, for their works will follow them." How could there be any greater meaning to our lives and work than the promise that our work will follow us into eternal life? That's where I'll end. And I look forward to, if anyone is new here, I don't know if any of you have been here before, we have discussion, but if you have to leave, feel free to leave at any point. No one's feelings will be hurt. Mine will not be hurt. But I look forward to any feedback, questions, thoughts. Well, churches do things differently. I know when we were at Swiss Le Brie, the children were in the service. In our black church, which is a long service, a lot of children are in the service, and they actually get, there is Sunday school as well. So I'm not saying there isn't Sunday school, there shouldn't be Sunday school. But I think, and I'm open to other, any ideas anybody has on this. I think what needs to be done is, whether there are Sunday school for age-graded Sunday school classes or not, and there's some reasons for that, some good reasons for that, there ought to be a lot of things that are cross-generational, activities that are cross-generational. And actually, it's interesting, at a workshop that I gave at a conference once many years ago, there was a teenager in the room, and she raised her hand. She said, "One of the things I love about my church is it's small enough that we do everything together." So she said, "There are people in the church that just want to get big enough so that we can hire a youth pastor and so that we can have all these age-graded activities." And she said, "I love it the way it is. We have picnics, we have contra dances, and all ages are there together. And I love it. One of my best friends is 60. And I think that's a wonderful perspective. So whether there are age-graded Sunday schools or not, there's a lot that can be done to, with the older kids and the adults, mixing, doing things together, having arts evenings, listening to the kids' music, encouraging people who play music to play music and listen to each other's music, watch films together and discuss them. The church that Dick was a pastor of when he lived in London, after we left, they were doing some very innovative things. The church had grown and there were more kids and more age range. But the teenagers would meet with the minister, whoever preached, afterwards and get to ask him questions and grill him. They had to outline. They took notes on the sermon and afterwards would get together, and it evidently improved the preaching a lot. the preachers, that it really helped. But they also did, at the church at Gretham, they did a thing which I thought was really helpful. We were there for one of these sessions. But they encouraged the kids, I don't know what age up, but to basically, they just had a big discussion, and anything was fair game. And the kids could write, they didn't have, if they were embarrassed to ask their question, they could write it down on a piece of paper, and there was sort of a moderator, and there wasn't just the minister, it was adults, but were thoughtful Christians who, you know, had thought about theology and thought about the Christian life, and kids, junior from middle school up, I think, and older kids who just had these discussions. And I think there's also work projects. So say if there is a youth pastor, I think one of the main pieces of the youth pastor job could be to organize these kind of things, rather than just feel like the kids are mine, they're my special domain. I'm protecting them from the rest of the church. We were members of a church for a while, and one of the things that drove me crazy was what went on in the youth group. And I still have in my mind one of the bulletins that the sort of advertisement, the bulletin for what the youth group was be doing. It was in December, so it was getting close to Christmas. So it was pizza and movies and shop till you drop. I thought, how condescending. These are teenage kids. They can handle up. They can handle more than consumerism, shopping till they drop, and just entertainment. Because like that young boy said at that teen thing, there's all sorts of issues. You know, in our culture, teenagers, adolescents are in a kind of unique position to have some time to think about these big questions that they're going to have to make decisions on in the not too near future, but without huge amounts of responsibility yet. So take advantage of it to help them think through those questions, talk about it with them, and a lot of the young people that we've known really appreciate that. I remember one student we had quite a few years ago who was, not sure how old she was, she might have been 19 or something, but she just bristled because someone offered her a teen Bible. And she knew she was capable of reading the Bible. She didn't need a teenage edited version that had, she said it had stories about acne and stuff in it. You know, that was meant to be the teen Bible. And she just felt so condescended to. So, I don't know. Anyone, other ideas about, or have any of you seen things in any of your churches that are working well, that are, yeah.
My sister goes to a church in Foxford. Mm-hmm. Some years ago, they asked the middle schoolers or mm-hmm. young high schoolers, what do they want? Mm. And they said, we don't want to feel like idiots when we tell someone about Jesus, and we want to go do something. And they ended up starting a ministry to the homeless in Boston, which lasted for some number of years.
See, that's awesome. So it was initiated by asking the kids themselves
what they wanted to do.
Yeah.
And they had
good ideas.
So the adult guides was to keep the ministry into the homeless in Boston safe.
Okay.
So the adults, I mean, they didn't clamp down on it. They just had a little bit of common sense.
Yeah.
And let the children have free rein. And it went apparently remarkably well.
Isn't that wonderful?
It lasted for multiple years.
Isn't that wonderful?
May still be going now.
Yeah. And that makes me think of something that is... Some things that have been done, there's getting elderly people together with young people can be wonderful. I mean, children or teenagers going into nursing homes, places where old people can feel very neglected, maybe don't have many family members to come visit them, and or getting elderly people who are tutoring kids. I mean, getting these two age groups that are at both ends of the spectrum together. And I've heard of that being very, very successful in a lot of places. Yeah, Anna.
Thank you for the party. This was really good.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Especially raising teenagers. So it's
particularly
helpful. I was wondering if in your research you found anything about, you know, why did child labor suddenly become a bad thing? And of course, some of the conditions were horrific.
Yeah.
Like, what brought that to people's awareness that suddenly, oh, maybe we shouldn't be doing this to children? Mm-hmm. I don't think you mentioned that.
No, there's... yeah, well, it was partly... There's a big section in this book I read on the history of childhood, which I didn't spend time on because I had to cut stuff out. But there was a real, a lot of it was Christians, actually, in the late 19th century. Christian churches and the rise of the Sunday school movement and so on was just seeing these, part of it was just seeing what was happening in urban centers. There were just this huge populations of immigrant children who were poor. Again, after the Civil War, huge numbers of orphans who were just loose in the street. And so there were quite a number. I combined with this kind of a more sentimental view of children, which was, there were people that had very sentimental view of children that made this, saw that as completely opposed to children doing any kind of useful work. I think that's a false distinction. But many of these child reformers were coming at it with that perspective, liberal Protestants or evangelical Christians who were very concerned to, you know, raise consciousness about the needs of these children. And part of it was, I mean, some people have criticized the way a sort of patronizing attitude. We want to Americanize you, and we want to various cultural things that that were part of Eastern European culture. Now we want to clean you up and make you more like us. But on the other hand, there were just huge numbers of kids were helped basically. And but it was I could give you, you'd enjoy reading this book, and you could. It's not, all the details aren't fresh in my mind, that part.
Can I make a comment?
Yeah.
My boys, so they're 11 and 13, mm-hmm. and they just love this film and then the play that was done called Newsies. You guys are familiar with it.
I've got to write this down. What's it called?
Boys, it's called Newsies, or is it The Newsies? It's just Newsies. I think it's just Newsies.
Newsies. Is the newspaper boys?
Yeah, they're newspaper boys, and they're basically orphans for the most part. They live on the street, and they kind of come together and, you know, fight the man who runs the newspaper. Mm-hmm. And they have work, and they have problems, and there's some romance, and there's friendship, and there's, you know, all kinds of challenges between these kids and the adults in the city. But I kind of wonder, like, what do they love so much about this?
Interesting.
And I think part of it is, like, this idea of, like, meaningful work and political opinions, and we could really have a say on the outcome of the city or of what happened in our local area.
And the kind of independence. I mean, what was so interesting, and which I'd read this before, but I'd sort of forgotten about it, but coming back, that in the mid to late 19th century, all these youth organizations were organized by kids themselves. Mm-hmm. They weren't adult-sponsored things. I mean, everything. Yeah. Actually, there were revivals that started at Williams College, at Bowdoin College, through prayer meetings of college kids that they started. They were not started by InterVarsity workers or Campus Crusade workers. They were initiated by students who started praying for revival, and real revival broke out. So, so it's interesting what this historian said about, you know, why did these young people submit to having their free time taken over and organized by adults? Well, partly because the adults had more facilities and better sports and money and stuff, but also because they had internalized a new view of themselves, that, you know, we're juveniles, we can't do this, adults can lead us better. Whereas they've been doing all these things, having debating clubs and everything, completely youth organized. So they're, you know, really, that's what I do love the social history, because it, again, it relativizes the present and makes us realize there's just nothing absolute about what's happening today.
Yes.
You know, and of course we can look around and see people doing a really great job, and seeing kids who are growing up who are not subject to all this kind of things that these early authors are worried about. But, Ingrid.
I wonder if also there's some level of, when work was shifted from the home and the community to, like, the factory, mm-hmm. There was concern about, like, dehumanizing.
Absolutely.
And depersonalization, because at least in the community, if you were working in the community, you were known and you were seen, you were regarded and respected and affirmed for what you were doing.
Yeah.
as a person, not just a worker.
Yeah.
And in the factories, it was a level of just you're a number, do your job, and we can like make it so that you have to work 12 and 14 hour days in order to keep your job. And so I can see how there was a Christian concern.
Oh, there was definitely. I mean, just
helping children escape from a real form.
Like, look at these children.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's horrible.
I know. No, and it was. And
yeah,
horrible accidents and yeah. So that definitely, I mean, industrialization was, it just, you know, ultimately it led to many people having a better standard of living. But the transition was horrendous. It was horrendously difficult. Whereas work had taken place in the home, when it was wrenched out of the home, you know, it caused a real crisis. And then people, these families needed their kids to work in factories. It was awful. So there's good reason for this. This is one of the reasons why I say we don't want to turn the clock back to this kind. Although there is illegal, you know, child labor that still goes on. Yeah.
I was going to say, related to that, one of my takeaways is for hope. There's three things that seem to be necessary. Mm-hmm. One is play outdoors, mm-hmm. unsupervised.
Yep.
Another is doing productive work.
Yep.
Another is seeing options for your future life.
Yep.
And industrialization takes away productive work.
Yep.
Because, I mean, I remember craving to work, but I couldn't because I didn't have a work permit. I had a paper route. That was it.
Yeah.
And the other one was not being able to see. If you're on a farm or in a community, you can see.
That's right.
The blacksmith, the barrel maker, the
That's
whatever.
Right. That's right.
But I was a tutor in Charlestown here, mm-hmm. and we were told that one of our biggest purposes for being there was so the children could see an adult who was not a police officer or a drug dealer or a teacher. I remember growing up the same way. My dad was an engineer, but I could not figure out what an engineer did. I asked him, So
taking kids to work is important if you can.
But even if you see it, even if you go to work, there's so much conceptual going on.
Yeah.
It would be pretty boring for a kid.